Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, February 1st, 2026, and this is episode 26 of The Rift. It's no secret that we are in a dire political moment. As climate and ecological breakdown continues largely unabated, and wealth continues to concentrate in the hands of a select few, we're seeing the emergence of a fascist regime in the United States that is not just scapegoating oppressed classes like racial minorities, queer and trans people, and undocumented immigrants, but is aiming the violence of the state at them in ways both frustratingly familiar and horrifyingly new. The recent murders of civilians by federal immigration enforcement agents in Minneapolis are the latest in a string of catastrophic and brutal events that have many people asking what they can do to fight back. At first blush, running for local office may seem like a vastly insufficient suggestion in the face of the erosion of whatever democratic pretenses America might have had to this point and the deployment of extrajudicial murder squads across the country. And to be honest, it's not necessarily the first suggestion that I would have for someone either. But the reality is that in a society as demobilized and atomized as the modern United States, the left needs to build locally from the ground up and organize on all fronts, in the streets and in the halls of power. And for some people, that might look like running for office in service of the people and movements out in the streets. Certainly, if we want to address ecological breakdown to the degree required, some amount of state power will need to be exercised. So for today's show, to talk about all of that, I caught up with a good friend of mine, Ada Recinos, the Associate Director of Marketing and Communications at the National Democratic Training Committee, a political organization that produces training materials for people running for office. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about how candidates have run for and won local political office by centering climate and environmental issues, and why electoral organizing matters in this moment. And as a reminder, the views expressed in this show are mine and those of my guests, and don't necessarily reflect those of WEFT, its board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. But first, programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Common Ground Food Co-op. Located in Lincoln Square Mall, Common Ground is Champaign-Urbana's only community-owned grocery store, specializing in local and organic foods. All are welcome and no membership is required to shop at the Common Ground Food Co-op. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode, now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com. And now, here's my conversation with Ada Recinos. I'm joined now by Ada Recinos, Associate Director of Marketing and Communications at the National Democratic Training Committee. Ada, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I hope you're also doing well, you know, given the circumstances.
Thanks. Yeah, it's kind of never ending in the political cycle right now, but we'll get through it.
Yeah. So just to start out, could you talk about what the NDTC is and what you guys do?
Of course. We are an organization that is not affiliated with the Democratic Party, though we do partner with a lot of organizations that train candidates across all 50 states. But we provide the training and the resources and the skill building that people need anywhere and anywhere. We really do mean that, to run for office. We'd like to prioritize those who are down ballot in local races, as much as we're seeing now that Congress and the White House is very important, building up really strong political power, particularly coming out of the climate movement, is going to start at home in our communities. And so that is where we invest the majority of our efforts, in finding people who are looking to run for school board or commissions or city councils.
Great. And how did you get into this line of work? I know, of course, you have your own history being a local elected official yourself. Was that kind of a factor in gravitating towards this?
It definitely was. Politics has always been in the background of my life. I come from an immigrant family. My parents are Salvadoran, and so we came to this country in the backdrop of a civil war. And so being involved in politics was always very important for my parents, and they instilled that in me at a young age. So I think I came preset with social justice in my veins. And so finding this role felt like a natural next step in what I'd been working on. I come from the climate activist space. I was really looking for a role where I could take a little bit of everything that I'd been working on over the past decade of my career, including being a city councilwoman, and try to find a way to pay it forward. Because, like I mentioned, where we are now is a symptom of a deep lack of investment in everyday people's lives. And a lot of that starts at the local level. And NDTC's focus is really to not gatekeep, no litmus testing. We don't take sides. We don't endorse people ahead of the primaries. We are a resource that is available to all who are looking to serve their communities. Of course, our specialty is for folks on the left, because we are very values-based. But we work very closely with people every year, because there are no more just election year work. We work in the off years as well. And in this recent year, in November of 2025, we saw about 970 of our NDTC learners win their elections across the country.
Yeah, and some of the folks who won those elections, and that's kind of why I wanted to talk to you about this, you have a few examples of people who ran on climate issues and on environmental issues and won their races doing so. And I know that that's going to be whatever amount of faith people might have or not have in electoral politics, it's part of movement building, right? Even if you're operating outside of the electoral sphere, having someone like that in a local office, and I'm speaking from personal experience, both having those people and really not having them, can make a huge difference in your local campaigns. So, could you maybe just tell the story of one of these folks or a few of them?
And definitely. So I think I'll start with Theresa Isom. She was a legislator in Mississippi who I believe broke and flipped a seat. So she broke a Republican supermajority by flipping her seat. She is a former nurse, educator, and healthcare administrator who's been active in doing community advocacy. And what we're starting to see is, I'll say it, it's a new type of climate candidate. It is a climate candidate that is reflective of their community. They're running on the ways that climate and the environment intersect local issues. So we're seeing a lot of folks who come from education backgrounds and healthcare backgrounds who really understand the ways that corporations and pollution might be affecting the everyday lives of their future constituents. And because that story of self is so ingrained in the campaign from day one, people are really rallying behind them. And we're seeing transformations that I think many years ago we could consider really unbelievable in some of the regions that we're seeing. Because a lot of these local races might be nonpartisan, we are seeing that people are doing more values-based campaigning. And because of the work of the climate movement over the last decade, I think that there's a lot of voters who are looking for common sense climate solutions, though they might not always look that way. They might look like oversight of some of the corporations in your town, if you're an industry town. It could look like someone looking to run for a water board, for example, to be able to regulate and or negotiate on behalf of their constituents and community to make sure that that resource is readily available. Another case that I have is Peter Hebert. He was a climate energy advocate, and he ran on lowering electricity costs. So what we're also seeing now is there is a lot of interest in people switching from private ownership of power to public, and that that is something that the climate movement kind of like normalized, educated the public about, and is seeing the average voter being enticed by the opportunity and what it means because it directly connects to their pocketbook. And so climate has become, in many ways, it's transformed into more of a kitchen table issue than it's ever been before. I think part of that is, I will say, the Trump administration and the heavy-handedness with which they've tried to unravel all of the environmental and climate protections. But I also believe that the average voter, and also people coming from the climate movement who maybe haven't voted before, are seeing themselves represented by this new generation of people running for office, where climate is not a single issue, but it's 100% integrated into their campaigns and the way that they're running them.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting for you in particular to talk about that as a new kind of candidate, because you know, my understanding is that's kind of what you were. You know, you were a city council person in Richmond, California, which is one of the homes of Chevron. There's a lot of people in the town who work there. There's a refinery there. And so, you know, you, as I understand it, didn't necessarily run on climate issues, even though you are a climate activist, but this was something that touched the lives of you and, you know, kind of everyone in Richmond, right?
It's very true. But when we were organizing and running as a slate in Richmond to try to hold a lot of these corporations accountable, because it's an interesting town. There was also, you know, Republic Services garbage that wasn't always following the rules, and a lot of constant air pollution from other facilities as well. And at the time, it was what we would get attacked on. We would get attacked on the climate candidates that were looking to take away jobs from the people of Richmond. During my time on the council, we tried to pass a ban on coal transportation through the city because so many residents that were near the coal terminal had increased rates of asthma. Some of the elders would have persistent issues with colds and illnesses, upper respiratory illnesses. We did the tracking where we tried to measure how much of the soot was actually ending up on people's cars, around their homes. It was a very real issue with, you know, to be honest with you, very real people involved. And a lot of them would come to testify to the city council. And the conversation back then was either or. We either get the jobs or we protect the people. And I will say that because we were so organized and so many of my colleagues were able to continue doing this work, Richmond is a very progressive town because it's not just about the one candidate either. The strategy was you build a coalition, you train the people on how to run, you train your community to know what issues are on the ballot. If there's an issue that's not on the ballot, you organize the people to put that issue on the ballot. It was a very civic oriented project. And for that reason, people could run and change things little by little And so I will say that back in that time, our city really became a case study on how to do that. And we were one of the first cities to jump on board to sue major polluting corporations for sea level rise, because Richmond has a coast. A lot of people don't think about, you know, this Richmond refinery town as a place with a beautiful coast, but we indeed had it, and it was deeply unprotected. And so we invested a lot in educating all community members, not just voters. And I think that that is also what we're seeing with a lot of candidates at NDTC, is candidates that are running with such conviction and such local values are turning out people who might have never voted before. You know, flipping a seat is a really big deal. That's usually going to involve converting voters, perhaps, who used to identify as Republican or moderates. It's going to also take a lot of people from no longer sitting out an election. So I will say we focus a lot on candidates, but the right candidate, the one who infuses climate in everything that they do because they have a background in education or nursing or as an entrepreneur, they're the ones who are building the largest coalition and the largest tent. And that is exactly what we're going to need to win the midterms, but also to hold the line, because we have more years of Trump. And then after that election, when we hopefully put someone better in power, there's going to need to be a large swell of electeds to rebuild. And so we see this as a very, very deep long-term plan to support people, everyday people, to run for office. And I'm personally, yes, very excited to know that several of the candidates that we saw win last November who were NDTC learners have that type of background, where they've pulled from those climate justice or environmental justice experiences and made it so that it was integral to who they are and not so much of a, I think what we're seeing now, even with in the White House, the Make America Healthy Again kind of like idea, is that you run on a slogan and that's kind of what it is, versus being like, I actually want to affect your pocketbook. I want your family to be better. I want to take care of you. And I think that that's what is making a really huge difference with the average voter right now.
You know, you're talking about these candidates who are right, very organic to the communities that they're running in, who have a real desire to make things better for the average person. In terms of campaigning on or addressing environmental issues, whether that's, you know, head on or through other programs, I know that, you know, in one of my prior episodes, I had Batul Hassan on, who was very involved in Zohran Mamdani's campaign. And, you know, he was another guy who he didn't really campaign on climate issues, but strengthening public transit and, you know, making schools more robust and all these things that are very, very related to climate adaptation. What are the issues that you're seeing that pop up in some of these communities? You know, whether it's Teresa Isom in Mississippi or someone else across the country, that are, you know, maybe super localized to one area or applicable across many different ones.
I think that one story that's really interesting, I'll talk about Michael Fagans in Virginia. I think that we've also kind of like had an entire segment of tech people and entrepreneurs who are reclaiming that space that I think we've kind of felt like is a little gone because of Elon Musk. But there are still people who come from that background who are looking to continue the transition. Like they're carrying the baton, perhaps, that at one time felt like a business trend. And we're seeing people kind of like still feel compelled to run. I'll say that I'm saying this a lot across the country, like not just in tech hubs where people are choosing to run on things like clean energy. And it's not like a thing to check off a list. It's bigger. For Michael, for example, it's about veteran job training. And it's about how do we continue this old goal of preparing young people or helping people transition in their careers to have those climate energy jobs locally, again, without having to compromise or give up so much. So this like new balance, I think, that people are finding where they're taking it upon themselves to say, I've identified and I was inspired by this vision that probably happened, you know, like 20 years ago, right? Where we're all supposed to be greening everything, and choosing to take that hyperlocal. And I think a lot of people are taking their lived experiences, like Michael's a veteran, and deciding that the issues that are most important to him, like Mom Donnie, who's like wants to do the free transportation, it is something that is uniquely accessible to them in their understanding, because you know, he's from New York and he has the template. He went and talked to the people. He was like, this is what they want. We have a lot of candidates who are doing a lot of deep listening. So they're taking their idea of what they think, you know, governing should look like, and they're validating it with the people that they want to serve. And people are no longer shying away from their identities and how that lived experience helps them build better platforms. So it's not so much a separation before, where I think it was like a lot of people were like, yeah, clean energy and jobs, we're going to bring that everywhere. I think there was a time where like every candidate was like, I'm going to do it. It felt like a little bit of a race. And there was a lot of compromising that was happening to get some of these big businesses to come to specific areas and you know, tax incentives, this and that. But I think candidates are doing a lot of reassessing about what it means to build those public-private partnerships, and really centering and focusing their agendas on what's going to better serve the people first, and getting a little bit more specific and hyper-focused on the expectations. And that can only come from candidates who really are trained and skilled enough to know how to use the fact that they have the voters' mandate for leverage in this new kind of climate experience where we're getting things handed down and deregulation is going to continue to happen. How do you have people hold the line? It's going to be these folks who are taking it upon themselves to run for water board or air board or commissions, who serve as the oversight and are kind of reclaiming the representation of the people from corporations who can, you know, put whoever they want on these commissions through unlimited funds. Because as we know, we can launch as many campaigns as we want, but at the end of the day, come election day, you need your people to turn out physically. That level of commitment is built over time. And that is where we come in. We build our trainings so that people get exactly what they need at the time that they need it. So we work cycle through cycle. We start with like how to build your team. We get into things like field over the summer. We dig into fundraising in a couple months so people can launch their campaigns. Right before we get out the vote, we're preparing people to get out the vote. And then we do support people with like understanding how to debut for your campaign. Did you succeed? What is the next step? If you succeeded, how do you keep building for the next step? How do you also not end the campaign with yourself? Because are you building that long-term community power with us? It means helping others who are running for office too. You're much more stronger if you have a community of other electeds or other people who are looking to make that change. So, you know, I think that for a while, folks wanted to kind of like, you know, demonize the woke. And we're seeing a return to authenticity. Like, it is not woke. It is who we are as people. And we're leading with what we know, acknowledging what we don't, building a team of people who come from the community. And all of that, again, is very much only possible when the tools you need to run for office are democratized. Otherwise, can it be a shot in the dark? Yes, we're all full of good intentions. But as I mentioned, the Republican Party has been building this really strong infrastructure for decades and invested a lot of money in it. And that's, you know, one of the other reasons why we offer all of this for free is because we want anybody who feels the values and convictions of the community are not being accurately represented, that they should run.
Yeah, I feel like I have several follow-up questions, but I want to start by going back, kind of way back in your answer to Michael Fagans, who was running on, you know, green jobs for veterans. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, when I was working in environmental justice in Detroit, we had a close relationship with an organization called We Want Green Too, shout out Mama Gloria, who that was their impetus was getting veterans placed in green jobs around Detroit. And now, you know, I'm here in Illinois doing more kind of climate labor stuff, and there's endless you know, community organizations whose goal is to prepare people for these jobs and to engage in local economic development. And it seems like the proliferation of nonprofits like that is part of this bigger pattern of like nonprofitization of social movements, which you know, is a bit of a mess, and certainly has its downsides. But I think the reality is that it has touched a lot of people. And I'm curious, when you see these candidates coming up, do they have that sort of background? Not necessarily like working in the industry or anything, but just kind of being affected by these organizations and saying, hey, you know, this is important to me.
We definitely see a lot of folks who are running for office who can recall kind of like a point in time where they feel called to do it. And we actually have a course and a live training that we do where people can kind of like dissect that. It's called So You Want to Run for Office. And it's kind of like a no judgment, join the call, explore what it is that has called you to feel like you should do this. Is it a specific movement that you've witnessed? Did you feel touched by an opportunity in your city that led to good change? Or are you finding that there needs to be an advocate against something horrible that's happening in your community? Or, I mean, in this case, or to your people, where you see like someone needs to step in and create those jobs for veterans. And then deciding that from there comes your why. It becomes part of where none of these candidates are reduced to why they felt called to it, but it becomes kind of like the root of their story. We also have a training called The Story of Self, where people can kind of explore like who you are and how that will make you a better candidate and a better elected. But part of the journey here is definitely understanding the reason behind why you want to run. And a lot of that includes like, you have these ideas. Do you have any perhaps connections? Can you run your platform by someone? Do you have folks in mind that you think would be able to partner with us? I remember back when I was working in Richmond, one of my big projects was workforce development. My dad is a union member. So I worked with this organization called Richmond Build. And we were trying to bring more folks to kind of find these job trainings to transition into the green economy in a way that was no cost to them. So they would do some courses, but really hands-on training. And then they would have kind of like career counselors there to help facilitate their job pursuits. And this was a project that I think at this point in time, you know, we're several years out, has won like so many awards because it's on the cutting edge. And I think that a lot of the folks that are looking to run for office are able to kind of build something new for their community, right? They have this vision. They have, as they're kind of like going around and asking people to support them, they're asking folks to kind of believe in this vision as well. And what we're finding is that that is what is ultimately going to make a candidate successful in the long term, and to be able to be authentic, get the votes, raise enough funds. A lot of the folks that we see that ran have like such a dynamic background and such a dynamic set of goals, and find themselves kind of like, I don't want to say they're not pigeonholing themselves. That's definitely not the term, but it's like finding ways to always tie it back to both their why and then also the why them for the regions that they're running in. For Michael Fagan's, his campaign, because he represents a coastal city, climate and environment is right there up against it. And because Virginia, veteran issues are right there as well. And so it is really amazing to see that I think what we've always known is true is the more you know where you're running, the better you're going to do. But I think what we don't always think about is like, yes, the path is paved with good intentions, but a lot of running for office is those hard skills. And that's why we exist, right? A lot of it is like, okay, this is like a platform that like anyone can run on and win technically, right? But there's no other Michael Fagan, one. There's also, I will say, like, time and place, right? We're up against this horrible Trump administration. I think Democrats have a little bit, just everyone on the left really, has a little bit of an edge to contrast. That's a factor. But it's also the technicality and the skill with which folks are able to not have to worry that their campaign is functional. We get a lot of people who send over like college students to us or like volunteers. I know some staffers on the Hill take our courses as well, because we're always trying to find like what's on the cutting edge around things like door knocking or mass text messages. When Apple makes an update, we have a take on that because we want everybody to maintain themselves informed and educated on what skills are needed to get to your next victory, yes, but also because democratic power should be shared. Democracy is a verb. We all have to participate in one way or another. And the right has benefited from lack of education, and it has benefited from people opting out of knowing how our systems work. They've made it so easy. So we definitely do see this with candidates, and we see the ones that are setting themselves apart are the ones who have these dynamic teams, a good story of self. And I will say we are the organization that supports like the largest amount of people who have won their elections. And part of that is because we have a breadth of work that we do, and what we provide is pretty grand. You know, we have like, I think thousands of things that we do. And resources that we provide, hundreds of Google Docs that we provide people. But the other part of it as well is democratizing it all, making it so that it's not gatekept and we don't get to decide who accesses our resources, making it readily available.
Yeah, and speaking of those resources, I think the other thing that I wanted to ask that you briefly mentioned before was this idea of training people to kind of maintain their movement beyond the election, right? And understand that the important thing here is having people power, and having educated, activated, engaged people living around you who care about these issues. Could you talk a little bit more about that? I think that that's very relevant to me personally, and I think also a lot of people on the left who are probably more skeptical of throwing their weight behind elections. You know, we've seen these examples in the past of candidates who did pretty remarkable movement building work, from Barack Obama to Bernie Sanders, and you know, now we just saw it again with Zohran Mamdani. And in some of these cases, you know, Barack Obama had this big organizing vehicle that mobilized a ton of people, and then he just kind of let it wither after he was elected. And you know, you saw our revolution with Bernie Sanders kind of forced to become its own thing. And again, you know, you get all these people engaged and enthusiastic, and then there's a question of like, mm-hmm. well, what for? And so often that energy just kind of falls away. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm curious about what you guys do to try and help people who are running for office understand that, you know, that keeping people in the fight is as important mm-hmm. As winning your election.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is a very common issue. And I'll say, I think one of the things that we all have to learn and internalize is that no one's coming to save us. No one election is coming to save us. No one candidate is coming to save us. We do provide tools for people to stop seeing themselves within the cycle of elections. So we do a lot of like relational organizing training, which is where it's not about knocking on the doors where you know that there's a Democratic voter. It's about you knowing the blocks that you live in and the people that you live next door to, the people who go to the school that your kid's at. It's the people who are at the coffee shop you go to every morning, the people that you talk to at the gym. And we do teach people that, like I said, that hard skill. And I do believe that the complement of that is there is no one institution that is going to be able to do that for us. We're going to have to tap in and tap out. We're going to have to see elections as one of the tools within our toolbox, but not the ultimate beacon or solution. But it is a very important one. I think that probably folks on the left underestimated how important it was until Trump kind of started waving a wand, because we had never seen this type of power be unwielded that way. There has always been if you made it to the White House, you have to have a level of decorum. You're going to want to run things by the other side, or there's an expectation that someone in that position would always act in good faith. And we know that that's not true anymore. And so, you know, taking together this training that we do on relational organizing and the way that we're helping people understand how they operate within their communities is one piece of it. The other piece of it is making sure that people understand the importance of these local and down ballot races, especially ones that are nonpartisan. And as we see it, you know, you've heard the term build the bench being thrown around. It really comes down to investing that and putting that on autopilot. Okay. You run for office, you win or you lose. What are you doing post-election? You have this great list. You have these great relationships. Are you handing them off? Are you maintaining them? Are you cultivating them? I've had the direct experience of this. When I ran for office, I was appointed to the city council, completed my term, ran for election, and didn't win. What do I do with all of that energy and all that hope, all those people that believed in our agenda, right? My friends and I turned that into a mini PAC, not a formal one, but a mini one. We called ourselves Women in Politics from Richmond, California. We would meet weekly and we started to think, how are we going to get a woman on the city council next year when there's another election? How can we continue to advocate for the things that were really important to us now that no one's there representing us, because it was an all-man council? And we felt that we had to show up because we were not going to let one defeat hold us down. And I think that you kind of trade in, tap out. There were women on this in this group who weren't showing up every time we had a meeting, but who were letting us know via email, like, hey, I feel like I have this issue. Maybe I'm going to go to the school board meeting, or I'll just write a letter or something. But it is making sure that our civic responsibility is something that we front load into how we do, kind of like how we pay our bills or how we do things that are part of a routine. There has to be some component of keeping up with what's happening to democracy locally and how politics is affecting our lives, whether we like it or not. And then I also will, you know, compare and contrast that with, know when you're getting to the point where you're no longer being productive and helping build the movement or a movement, and you gotta kind of like take your time to rest. But you need to have had built mentorship opportunities. You need to have someone else who's ready in the wings to tap in for you. We have to be more intentional about supporting other leaders in the ways that they lead. You know, not everybody can be Barack Obama, who's this beautiful orator who can make these speeches that take your breath away and inspire you to take action. That's not just what leadership looks like. It can look like folks who organize around like meal trains for the person who just had a kid and they're going to have to be in bed rest for a little bit. That's a political action in and of itself. And we do a lot of that already. So it's, I think, integrating it more into all the aspects of our lives and where we interact with others. It's, you know, I'll say it starts at a small scale as like where you shop, where, who you give tips to. It's those daily interactions. And in the longer sense, it's understanding that there are no longer any off years. We have to kind of keep that in our back pocket. Every year that there's elections somewhere that are going to affect you in one way or another, the minimum thing you should do is be aware of who's running. And if you find yourself in a place where someone's running unopposed and their ideas are kind of sketchy, you're going to have to decide, are you running or do you know someone who should? And then you're going to have to support them. I think it's like, and support looks different. It can be time. That's definitely valuable. It can be money. You know, I have friends who are still in the tech industry in SF. They don't have time, but if I ask them to donate $1,000, they'll probably do it. And that can go a really long way in some of these smaller elections, right? But also it can be things like sharing power. If you're someone who has like really great connections to friends, to businesses, to folks who have capital, folks who have more connections, those need to be facilitated as well. There's not one person who's going to save us, but each of us can play some sort of role in making electoral politics less painful. So we all got to tap in one way or another.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we were running out of time a little bit here, but as we wrap up, I did kind of want to bring it back to, you know, talking about climate candidates and the climate and environmental justice movement more broadly. You know, all of this stuff, you've spoken about like a really wide range of issues and skills and motivations of people who might be running for office. What lessons can you take from those elections and those experiences that you feel any climate activist or environmental justice activist might be able to take away from that?
I definitely encourage them to stay authentic. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about kind of this new climate candidate who might not make climate their center focus, but I do think that some climate activists might feel like, no, that's who I am. And that it's integral to how they want to be perceived and how they want voters to feel about them. And I think the most important piece of advice is, if you live in a community where that is true, then that is how you should run as a climate activist. I'll give a final story, an example. Michael Jones, House District 77. Virginia House has been serving since 2024. He ran as a local leader focused on environmental justice, specifically trying to protect tree canopy and protect his community from flooding. He wanted to work on climate resilience and wanted to be a better representative for those in Richmond. And the most impactful thing that any climate activist who's looking to become a candidate can do is to be true to themselves and to see that reflected in the people that they're going to work for. And if that looks like jobs, then it should be jobs. If that looks like some, you know, cleaning up waterways, then it's waterways. If it's air pollution, then dig into that. I don't want anybody to think that they have to be the broadest candidate for everyone, because I think that is really hard for a climate activist to kind of digest, right? There's a very common misperception that to run for politics, you have to tone some of yourself down. You have to be digestible by everyone. And I think that is kind of how we ended up in this situation, where you have politicians who are very cookie cutter. You can't tell one from the next. You're not sure what their convictions are. You're confused about their values. There's a lot of backdoor dealings still happening. And that is where we differ on the left. That is what the Republicans can claim, is that they can pick and choose whoever they want, throw money behind it, and they can buy as many votes as their heart desires because they have corporations on their side. But I'm not going to let us fall into the trap of thinking for a moment that that is why we should give up, because there are too many good people, and we've seen at NDTC so many great people run for office authentically as themselves and win. People want to support other people. We are humans who want to recognize each other's humanity. There are folks who are far gone, you know, Republicans who are growing in their hatred, but there are so much more of us who believe in each other and that we can be better for each other. And the climate candidate that's going to win time and time again is the one who is authentic to themselves, authentic to what they want to accomplish, because when they get elected and they are held accountable for what they promised, it's not going to be going from this point to that one. It's going to feel seamless. It's like, you know, take it back to Mom Donnie, I think is a great example. People were like, he'll soften up on his hard stances once he gets in office because the institution kind of like turns you into a different person. I don't think that that's true anymore. All the rules are out the window, unfortunately, in a very challenging way. But it's also allowed us the opportunity to dream and envision a future and a candidate and an elected that works in lockstep with its community, reflects it, and is going to make the right choices. And if anything, because we work so deeply and so locally, that we will support people to be educated and knowledgeable and confident enough to expect that from the candidates that run and from the electeds that win.
Well, that's as good a place as any to put a bow on things, I think. But one last thing, Ada, where can people follow your work and DTCs?
Yes, amazing. So folks can find us at traindems.org. Again, not affiliated with the Democratic Party. Don't feel like you're signing up for the Democratic Party mailing list or anything like that. All our trainings are 100% free. All you have to do is make an account and everything is accessible to you. We help you from everything to making call lists to figuring out how you're going to raise thousands of dollars to win your campaign and everything in between.
Cool. You heard it here first. Any champagne socialists, if you were, that's where to go if you would feel so inclined. But Ada Recinos, Associate Director of Marketing and Communications at the National Democratic Training Committee. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you all choose to pursue running for office or at least get a little curious about it.
That was my conversation with Ada Recinos of the National Democratic Training Committee. Ada is truly one of the sharpest and most thoughtful organizers and activists that I know, and I want to thank her again for taking the time to come on the show today. For me, the takeaway is simple. The left needs allies in office. As Ada herself said, it's not the solution, it's not a silver bullet, and it's certainly not going to save us. But it can be a piece of a much larger fight. And given what we're seeing these days, it's safe to say that we need everyone we can get. That's it for today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be Sunday, February 15th. Until then, take care.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Most people rarely or never take a flight, but a small number of elite travelers fly a lot, often in business class or even on private jets, and they have an outsized impact on the climate.
It's clearly something where not everyone around the world is contributing to the pollution.
Frederic Roder is with the Global Solidarity Levies Task Force. It's an initiative that's developing new ways to raise money for climate adaptation projects, especially for efforts in low-income countries that suffer the most from climate change. She says one promising approach is for countries to put a tax on tickets or fuel for premium air travel.
What the initiative is targeting is really those flying the most, flying business class, first class, private jets. So not the persons that might take a flight once a year to see their family or to go on vacation.
The task force helps coordinate a small but growing coalition of countries, including Spain, France, Kenya, and Nigeria, that have pledged to pursue the approach, and is working to get other countries on board. Roder says it's a way to help fund climate solutions by asking travelers generating the most climate-warming pollution to pay a greater share of the costs. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Trump administration has proposed to sell new oil and gas leases across more than a billion acres of U.S. coastal waters.
This would open up the entire coast of California, most of the Gulf of Mexico and most of the waters around Alaska and the Arctic to new oil and gas development.
That's Pete Stauffer of the nonprofit Surfrider Foundation. The administration says new leases will boost domestic energy production and provide revenue. But Stauffer says oil and gas drilling pollutes water, hurts wildlife, and can harm coastal industries like fishing and tourism. And oil spills can be devastating. New oil and gas leases also keep us dependent on fossil fuels, which emit carbon pollution and warm the climate.
And these lease sales can last for 30, 40, or 50 years. So it really is a generational impact.
The federal government is accepting public feedback on the proposal online. And people can also contact their state and local leaders.
We have seen in the past, particularly bipartisan opposition from local and state and federal elected officials, can be very influential in stopping new offshore drilling.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. For nearly a decade, U.S. Representative Mike Quigley of Illinois has taken annual trips to national parks, not for vacation, but to raise awareness about how the parks are being harmed by climate change.
They're so beloved. They're the quintessential national natural treasure. And if they're endangered, nothing is safe.
Quigley's climate change tours have taken him to Florida, where rising seas threaten the vulnerable wetlands of the Everglades, and to Maine, where warming temperatures are accelerating the spread of invasive species in Acadia. He's gone to California, where wildfires threaten giant sequoias in Yosemite, and to Alaska, where melting permafrost is increasing the risk of landslides in Denali. On each visit, Quigley talks to researchers and park rangers about the changes they're seeing. He brings other members of Congress with him to help them understand these impacts too, and he shares what he learns on social media.
We want to show everybody that it affects all corners of the country.
And Congressman Quigley encourages people to get involved and push for climate action.
We have to continue to act. We owe it to future generations.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
To the radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of the endless spring.
Hi, this is Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, and you're listening to 90.1 FM Champaign, WEFT.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. February's performances include the Mark Morris Dance Group with a new work, Moon, on February 13th and 14th. Lyric Theater's annual celebration of Carnival on February 17th. Contemporary classical ensemble Brooklyn Rider with special guest Iranian musician Kayan Kaler on February 24th and a hip-hop convene February 25th through the 28th. Complete information on these performances is available at KrannertCenter.com.
At WEFT, we believe that diversity in programs and participants makes for a more robust and more interesting radio station. WEFT has come a long way in 40 years, and we are still evolving. Listener contributions make this possible. Donate now by going to weft.org and click on the Support WEFT link at the top of the page.
We all have something of value to give to a child. One in three young people are growing up without a mentor, someone outside of their family who they can turn to for support and guidance. Want to make a difference and have fun at the same time? Learn how you can close the mentoring gap at www.cu.